We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about AIDS. AIDS continues to be a major health problem around the world. It's estimated that in 2008, 2 million people died as a result of AIDS-related illness. At the same time, public health officials do say that progress has been made in fighting the disease. The number of new HIV infections peaked in the mid-90s, and people who have the virus that causes AIDS are living longer with the help of medical therapy. This morning in this hour, we'll try to talk a little bit about some of the most recent numbers we have on AIDS and also talk about research and treatment. And our guest for the program is Dr. Helmut Albrecht. He's professor of clinical internal medicine and director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the South Carolina School of Medicine, which is affiliated with the University of South Carolina. He is a specialist in this area, has done a lot of research and work on HIV and AIDS. And he's joining us this morning by phone. Questions are welcome. We hope people will stay on topic for us and keep their questions brief, but questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. Toll-free, 800-222. And you may also send along your questions by email. Just write to will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, your questions certainly are welcome. And Dr. Albrecht, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. And how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
Just had to run over here from the clinic, but barely made it. I am here.
I am very glad to have you with us. The thing I thought it would be good to start out here with here is just is some numbers. The most recent, I think, that we have, or at least the most recent I could find, are numbers from statistics from 2008, and these come from the World Health Organization. And that is 33.4 million people living with HIV, 2.7 million new infections, 2 million deaths. If we were doing this conversation, let's say, I don't know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, what would those numbers have been?
Fairly similar. The overall number of diagnosed cases would be lower. One would have to say that there's always a lot of patients that are undiagnosed in this number. So part of that is an estimate.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, we have less people dying per year. That number actually in the past has been higher. That was as high as 5 million people dead per year. And that has obviously gone down. That has gone down worldwide. In sub-Saharan Africa, not as dramatically as here in the U.S., for instance, but it's certainly come down. 2 million lives lost, including almost 500,000 children of that, is still a way too high number for starters, I think.
Mm-hmm. In the United States, just sort of to do the same thing, and these numbers come from the Centers for Disease Control, we have more than 1 million people living with HIV. 56,300 new infections. I think this is also for 2008. 18,000 plus deaths every year. Is that, again, would you say the same thing that, well, really, aside from the fact that we have fewer people dying, that overall, in terms of new infections and numbers of people who are HIV positive, that really hasn't changed very much?
It's incredible how little dent we've actually made into new infections, really over decades now. And part of that is that we feel in order to change something of this, we got to change the number of new infections. The deaths, we have really put a major dent into this. It's actually going up a little bit again. But overall, that number is significantly smaller, which what that means is that we have overall more patients than we used to. in the 80s when everybody talked about this, we had comparably to today probably 10% of the patient numbers overall that were in care that we have to deal with now, with sort of the similar amount of funding to support them, which is, and we can get back to that later, it's obviously one of the major problems right now. But overall, the new infection rates have not been affected as much as we hoped we would or could or should.
Let's stay with for a moment with the other part of this, and that is the fact that fewer people die every year, people who are HIV positive. And I suppose if one is going to point to some success in this, this has been the development of antiretroviral viral therapies, drug therapies, that make it possible for people who are HIV positive to live for long periods of time without developing AIDS, by using these drugs to try to hold down the production of the virus in their bodies. And that's what it is that makes it possible for these people, even though they're HIV positive, to live more years than they would have otherwise.
Correct. We're now in this decade, in the last 5 years, we think we've come very close for HIV patients to expect a normal lifespan. So we think that the overall prognosis of an HIV patient is going to be affected by a lot of other things, but probably not by their HIV anymore. Mm-hmm. In case they can take the meds, in case they can tolerate them, have access to them, and those kind of things, they should be able to really lead a long and potentially productive life.
You've put in some important qualifications there, that the therapies now, what is now known as the highly active antiretroviral therapy, known by the initials HART, it is expensive. The regimen is somewhat complicated, and, you know, these multi-drug cocktails, you have to take them in a certain way. There are the possibility of side effects, so I suppose with any medication, the question is, can the patient tolerate the medication? There are a number of qualifications here, though.
Sure. On the other hand, over the last 10 years, our medications have probably not gotten stronger, but they've certainly become a lot better tolerable and a lot easier to take. So mm-hmm. the regimens have gotten a lot more convenient. We've gone in 10 years from when the first cocktail came around, which was around 16 pills, which had to be taken 3 times a day, some of them, and with or without food, to essentially one pill once a day, which can be taken with or without food. And right now we have one such cocktail in one pill. In 3 or 4 years, we're probably going to have 4 or 5 of those. We're currently in the research setting working with such compounds already that will add to our armamentarium on that. And again, while they are not a whole lot stronger or potentially more effective, just thinking that we can get this entire cocktail into one pill and that there's 3 or 4 or 5 different options depending on your patient type, it's actually pretty dramatic in the time frame that we've had these kind of cocktails.
Mm-hmm. Is there concern that resistance, though, that might develop?
Resistance can develop. Yeah. Most people, like with bacteria, think something mutates there. What happens is the virus, what we call replicates, it makes a new copy of itself, and the new copy has a flaw in it. And if that flaw happens to be advantageous when you're on medication, then this one will take over. The good news is if you suppress a virus completely, and while it's not dead, it's sort of similar, dead bugs don't mutate, we can prevent this certainly for decades. We don't know much longer. We've had these medications since 1996. But we have patients on the same regimens now for more than a decade, doing very, very well. As long as the virus is completely suppressed, which takes an enormous amount of discipline, this can be done for a very long time.
Is there benefit for people who have gone from being HIV positive to actually having the diagnosis of AIDS? Is there a benefit to a person, for a person like that, to take these medications?
Yes. You go through a phase where they are more vulnerable, but most of my patients that were diagnosed with AIDS in the meantime have gone back to having a fully normal immune system. There are issues with that once the virus has done certain damage, not only in numbers, but also in the quality of the immune response, that you may not get all of it back, which is one of the reasons why we're advocating now progressively more early therapy again. But overall, these patients will go back to a risk for pneumonias or other infections, which is essentially zero on therapy. Most of my patients have higher CD4 cell counts than I have, and I'm not infected. So the CD4 cell count is the measure of the immune system for this kind of virus. But yes, this is essentially fully reversible on these medications.
Yeah. Certainly there was a point where people were talking about the day coming when we would go from being infected with HIV being a death sentence to being HIV positive as being something that we would consider to be perhaps a manageable chronic condition, and that with the right kind of support and management, that person could expect a normal lifespan.
Yeah.
Is that the point we are now, or is it not quite there, but almost?
No, I think we're there.
We're there.
It's complicated enough that you really have to have specialists dealing with this nowadays. It used to be that everybody could do this. There was nothing else to do. But it's become as complicated as chemotherapy regimens, essentially. Mm-hmm. But if you know what you're doing, if you have a patient-provider relationship that can hold this, I think it's a whole lot worse nowadays as an 18-year-old medically, maybe not socially, psychologically, and that kind of thing, to develop a cancer, diabetes, those kind of diseases, than to get HIV. At least from the treatment side, I think we're way better than most other chronic threatening illnesses.
You know, I'm sure that would strike some people as being a remarkable statement, and that they would be surprised to hear you say something like that. Do you think that that is generally understood?
No, I don't think so. And if it's understood, it's understood in the wrong way, i.e., we don't need to take precautions anymore. This is treatable.
Mm-hmm.
It will require taking very expensive medicines for a very long time. In all honesty, that's not much different than from other chronic diseases, but it's certainly there's very little that you can do once your liver, your heart, your kidneys, or your lungs are down. Kidneys you can replace with dialysis, but otherwise you need to replace the organ. We can actually reverse this terminally damaged immune system and can improve this again. And again, the life expectancy, given all the obstacles we said, having access to medications, having the ability to get them, having the ability to tolerate them, again, the life expectancy should be normal for somebody nowadays infected with HIV.
The point that you made earlier about the fact that one certainly positive development is that we have people who are HIV positive are living longer, so fewer people die every year.
Right.
At the same time, what you said, what disappoints a lot of people who work in this field is that we, in terms of the numbers of new infections every year, we've hardly put a dent in them, which I'm sure leads people to say that, well, certainly we need to put emphasis on treatment, no doubt about it, but that we should continue to put emphasis, maybe even more so, on prevention And I know that there are, I think that there are people who are really very concerned that when it comes to AIDS, particularly here in the United States, that perhaps there are too many people who have gotten into that frame of mind you suggest that says, well, it's really, maybe at one time we thought it was a big deal and it was a death sentence, but it's not so much anymore. And yeah, you don't want to get it, but if you do, there's drugs that you can take. And do you really think that that, you're starting to see more of that kind of attitude that is way too casual about the whole thing?
Sure it is. And on everybody's side, it's from the funding side, from the political side, from your side, from the press side, which when was the last time you saw HIV on the front page of the newspaper? Now that it's 10 times as prevalent as it is when it was on everybody's front burner. So yes, there is a overall a casual approach to this. And one thing one can't forget, yes, all our medications have gotten better, but we still have 18,000 people die of this every year, right? So it's still a virus that's trying to kill you. And if everything goes right, then that's not going to be the case. But we still have a lot of patients whose life is dramatically affected, changed, and probably ended by this virus every year. But we certainly think, all of us, that there needs to be a lot more emphasis on prevention. People also have the misconception this is only affects people that have sex with men, women, and everything that moves and grooves, and unless you do something really abnormal, you're not going to get this. This is a disease that has an incubation period of 10 years, right, until you show the first signs of infection, some after 5 years, but some not after 15 years. On average, it takes you 10 years to get this, to this stage called AIDS, when you have actually infections and people get ill. If you only infect one other person in that time and don't die yourself, the epidemic has doubled. This does not go away as easily as people would think. And the way that humans are, it requires in 10 years only giving the infection to one other person. That does not require any sort of abnormal, unusual, or aberrant behavior. This is very human for this not to go away until we put a big effort into this. And we can talk about that too, but it obviously requires a completely different approach than we have taken in the last 20 years to this.
Let me introduce again, just very quickly, the guest for this hour of Focus. We're talking with Dr. Helmut Albrecht. He is professor of clinical internal medicine and also director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the South Carolina School of Medicine. And in his research work, he has done a lot of work on HIV and AIDS. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. You talked about the fact that one doesn't see this on the front page of the newspaper very much, and I suppose that one thing that does get the attention of the news media, and perhaps it's the reason that we thought it would be good to do a kind of an update, is when we have the periodic big international AIDS meetings, the most recent one, meeting of the International AIDS Society, took place in Vienna. It was about a month ago, and certainly did get some attention. One of the things that I have read is that this suggestion that perhaps within the field, in the past, there had been a lot of argument between people on the one hand who said treatment should be the big priority, and those who said actually it should be prevention that's the big priority. And one of the changes now seems to be that there is this recognition that you can actually do both and really need to do both.
Yeah, I think that's exactly correct. If you don't do both, we're not going to get this done. Right now, 1% of the world's population has HIV. Given what I've just told you about the long incubation period and how easy it is to double this epidemic, we can't wait any longer, and we will eventually run out of money to treat people that are affected. And I think they go together. If you prevent this, one of the ways we're currently trying to prevent this is diagnosing people early and get them into therapy so that they're less infectious and don't transmit the virus. It requires both pieces of this thing to be successful with any strategy. You can test all you want. If you have no means to treat the people that you find, that will fall short. But as long as you only sort of mop up afterwards and keep a steady stream of patients going into this, it's going to be a never-ending cascade. Hmm.
Given that, as you say, that an individual could be HIV positive for a decade and have no symptoms,
right,
and all during that time have the possibility of passing the infection along to another person,
right,
then it seems like it would be really important here that individuals who are at risk be tested. So at the very least, they should, if they are HIV positive, they should know their status. How do you get that to happen?
Well, the CDC has given this a lot of thoughts, and I think one of the ways we've discovered that our current approach is not working is the numbers you've cited that have really not changed. And the risk-based testing approach has not worked at all. Part of that is that people either don't feel that they're at risk, or they don't want, in a certain situation, don't want to tell about that risk. And most people that we do find eventually really did not consider themselves at risk. So the new recommendations are fairly simple. If you're somewhere between 16 and 64, if you've been sexually active, you should be tested for HIV if you go into medical care, which means that every provider should offer an HIV test when they draw blood, whether they draw liver tests, kidney tests, check you for anemia, they should also draw an HIV test at the same time, regardless whether you come for a broken bone, regardless whether you come for a pregnancy or for any other symptoms, you should routinely be tested, which also means that you then have to have a system in place that funnels these patients into therapy afterwards.
Mm-hmm. And you're, though, in that case, this is still voluntary. That is, it is the CDC recommendation that you ask people if they would consent to be tested?
What we are going to, or what we're trying to achieve, is to go from opt-in. You have to ask, do you really want this, to we're going to do this unless you tell us that you don't want it, which is an opt-out strategy. Currently, the only place we did this before these new guidelines came out was in pregnant women, where we really said we should, not only for you but also for your baby, test you for various STDs, for various diseases, including HIV. Virtually every woman accepts that, and it's been remarkably successful. We have gone down from more than 1,000 new babies infected to really being an incredible exception, with less than 50 babies born to HIV-positive mothers then being HIV-positive themselves in the last years or so. So this strategy, we know, we have some precedent that this can work on a small scale. It's really not clear whether that's going to be the solution, but certainly what we've tried before with the risk-based strategy, that hasn't worked at all.
Mm-hmm. Any idea? I'm sure that if you did this now, we're not going to be testing everybody, but you're going to pick up people who, as you say, for whatever reason, are going to come into medical treatment. They're having blood drawn for some other reason, and so you say to them, "Well, we're going to do this unless you say no." So I expect that that means we're going to test a lot of people, and we're going to get a lot of negatives. We will pick up some people who do. Is there any way of estimating how many people we think we're going to pick up that way that we're not getting now?
Now, we think that a quarter of the infected people in the U.S. don't know that they have this.
Okay.
This quarter, this 25%, however, are responsible for more than 50% of the new infections that we see. So it's a very important segment of the population to get to. And again, the risk-based approach, I have teenagers myself, they don't feel at risk because they're either not gay, they're not a specific race, they're not in those circles where they think this goes on. I'm in a small town in Columbia, South Carolina, which has rates that are higher than San Francisco and New York of HIV. People here, down here, don't feel that they're at risk just because they're in a fairly sheltered environment and feel that it doesn't happen here. And it's burning down here.
Well, it certainly seems to be in the past, in the educational efforts that we've done, we have concentrated on categories of individuals. That is, we have said, okay, who's at the greatest risk? Well, the number in the United States, the number one category of person who is at greatest risk are men who have sex with other men. Now, we maybe in the past we said that was gay men, and so the problem there was that, well, there may be men having sex with other men who don't consider themselves to be gay. So we have that category. We have injection drug users. Could it be that we've made a mistake in not being specific enough about behaviors that put you at risk for infection, and instead stressing these sort of like groups, and that give people the option of saying, well, I'm not a member of that group, so I'm not at risk?
Exactly, and the new strategy should get rid of that approach completely. Of course, men who have sex with men are at high risk. There's biological and social reasons for that. But in South Carolina, for instance, we have more heterosexual transmissions than homosexual transmissions. And the group is just very much larger than the MSM group that we have down here. So once it's broken into these large groups and there's no real distinction, we've completely given that up, essentially, in the prevention efforts. We want to find everybody that's out there. Sure, you will find more positives in certain groups, but we've learned that whenever we concentrated on one group, the epidemic shifted to another group who felt that they were not at risk. And it doesn't take a whole lot. It takes one sexual encounter. I have a young lady who's raped as a mail carrier. It was her only sexual encounter. It doesn't take a whole lot of contacts to become infected. And the virus doesn't discriminate. It doesn't care whether you're male, female, brown, black, white, yellow, green, purple. It really does not care. So I think our testing approach has to adjust to this somehow, that the virus really doesn't discriminate.
One of the things that I think certainly has been advocated in along the line of prevention, and something that I think particularly other places around the world has actually been demonstrated to be successful, it seems to be a relatively simple thing, and that is the use of a condom. Is that in fact something that we can say this will go some significant way to limiting the spread of the disease, and that if we could simply get people to use them, that that would make a difference?
Sure, condoms make a difference. Not 100%, but in 8 years where it was very difficult on federal sites to talk about condoms, the rates of condomless sexual activity went up dramatically. While that was not as acceptable under the Bush administration, where condom information was pulled down from federal websites, we had a significant backlash with significantly less condom use. It is not the only solution. It's only part of the solution. But for us, I think one has to come up with a strategy that allows everybody to get in. One of the big differences would be a protective vaccine. But until we have that, we got to use all other ways that we have, treating STDs, which make people less infected, and trying to look into microbicides, certainly advocating condom use knowing that there's nothing right now that protects 100%. However, 90, 80%, whatever the protection is still a whole lot better than not doing anything at all.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that came out of this of the recent meeting, the Vienna meeting, was this announcement, and it was made right at the beginning, that researchers have developed a vaginal gel that a woman can use that would cut in half her risk of getting HIV from an infected partner. And it's thought that this would be particularly helpful in those cases where perhaps a woman cannot persuade her partner to use a condom. How important a development is this?
Extremely. I mean, there's two preventative measures. One is the vaccine. One is the other one was what we call a microbicide gel that would allow patients that cannot decide freely over their own sexuality to protect themselves somehow. And this was a quantum leap. It's not perfect, as you said. Mm-hmm. It's actually more than half effective for people that use this as prescribed, which not everybody did in this study. But it's a quantum leap in so far as it allows women to do something themselves, not only ask their men, male partners to use condoms, but actually something that they can do themselves. And it's and so far very different because this was the first microbicide gel that did not use something that would kill sperm or that would kill any other particle or inhibit the movement of sperm, but this was actually an HIV medication, a real drug, as we talked before. It's one of the typical components of our antiretroviral regimen made into a gel, so a direct HIV effect. Interestingly enough, it also protected from herpes, too, in that study. But this is certainly a major step in the right direction. It's not the solution, and it certainly does not change the need for education, prevention, and condoms, but it certainly adds a component to what women can do, especially in the developing world, where they're often not the ones that make the choice when and how to have sexual activity.
Mm-hmm. Is this a particularly expensive product?
It is more expensive than something that is a simple soap or detergent-based approach, yes. What the price is going to be of this, we don't know. But it's going to be more expensive than, again, a simple detergent.
Hmm. Maybe I should just, again, take a moment here to introduce our guest, Dr. Helmut Obrecht. He's professor of clinical internal medicine and director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at South Carolina School of Medicine. That's affiliated with the University of South Carolina in Columbia, South Carolina. His special interests include HIV and AIDS. And we're talking here just about where things stand with HIV and AIDS in the United States, around the world. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign Urbana number. Toll free 800-222-9455. And we do indeed have email as well. If you want to send along your question that way, it's will-talk@illinois.edu. Where do things stand now with the research on a vaccine for AIDS?
Well, We're nowhere close where we need to be. In all honesty, we have not yet completely defined what protects some people more than others. So before you can design a vaccine, in my view, you really have to define protective immunity, and we haven't done that. What I can tell you is that the usual approach gives somebody some inactivated or dead part of the virus and wait until the body makes antibodies is not going to work in this case. The virus is too mutagenic. It mutates and changes too fast for that kind of approach. And every one of my patients has antibodies. There are certain antibodies that are more protective, but that's not going to be the solution. This is going to be a major, major change in our thinking, how this will work. I think it's going to require a genetic approach and potentially a stem cell-based response, but it's going to be something entirely different than what we've seen in other vaccine fields. And in all honesty, I do not see a vaccine candidate right now that I think is going to get us there.
Mm. And how long have scientists been working on this question?
Since they've discovered the virus, essentially since 1983.
Mm.
This is going to be difficult. Hepatitis C will be another virus that will have significant issues with this. This is a virus that works somewhat differently from other viruses, so we will need a new approach. What a lot of people probably also don't know, that the first patient has actually been cured. That was a confluence of very different factors. It was a patient with leukemia who got a stem cell transplant with a very strange defect which didn't allow HIV to get into the cell, was a perfect match with you. So it was a 1 in 50 million option for this particular patient, and he had to survive a grueling chemotherapy and preparation regime for this. But I think the one case illustrates that if we take a different approach to this, which is probably altering the binding structures to this, altering some alterations in the cell themselves, i.e. a completely new approach, I think it can be done, but it's not going to work with traditional vaccine technology.
We have a caller to talk with in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. There's a parallel problem, I guess. It appears that the antibiotics that we've used to treat secondary infections are going to become increasingly ineffective over the next perhaps 10 years. How is this going to affect the treatment of AIDS? And do you have any suggestions of possible strategies?
Well, I assume you're talking about that we have progressive resistance in bacterial and fungal pathogens, which really requires us to change our antibiotics every couple of years in order to be ahead of these things. And we're seeing viruses that are multi-drug resistant or resistant to all the medications that we have. One of the ways to avoid that is really making sure that the patients take these correctly. And probably the most important thing, and that's why it's very clear that specialists have a significant role in this, the outcome of this resistance development, what we're essentially talking about, is significantly less when you have people that actually know what they're doing, really know how to combine these new drugs, use these new drugs, not burn them one by one, which is not the most effective way to do this, but actually to combine new medications, new regimens together, and really figure out, based on sophisticated resistance tests, how to do this. It can be avoided, not in all cases. I have patients that are not responding to these therapies anymore. It's still better to have a treated but not as responsive virus as having no treatment at all. We've certainly made a major dent into this. The one downside of this is that we need companies to continue to find new medications, and we're seeing a trend with the current cost of running these studies and doing these things, that less and less companies are interested in doing this. And certainly research is going to continue, but we're seeing less and less candidates come up at these conferences like the one I just attended. We're seeing less new compounds entering the advanced research phases. And that is a problem. I agree with that.
Does that get at your question, caller?
I have two follow-up questions. One, would it help to take antibiotics out of agriculture? Because that seems to be where a lot of the resistance is beginning to develop and transferred to other organisms. And the other is, would funding research on new drugs at the university level, where there's less interest in the bottom line, be useful strategies? Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, the latter question, by all means, it's I'm somewhat troubled that we leave all the new drug development to commercial companies. That doesn't mean that they're not doing a good job, but it obviously has the implication that certain orphan drugs, we should be able to have drugs for malaria and vaccines for these kind of illnesses that unfortunately only affect very poor people where nobody has an interest. And if we still don't have drugs for these kind of illnesses, that should be fairly easily conquered. And yes, there is a problem with that. So another source of funding stream, there is some. There's basic research which goes to the early development, and the NIH is fostering that. But the latter development is currently, for these kind of drugs, entirely, that's our system, in the hands of commercial entities, which has some advantages, but as you stated, big disadvantages too. The other thing with antibiotics in agriculture is not completely related, but certainly that is a major, major issue. Whether we paint antibiotics on submarines and antifungals for barnacles to what we feed our animals to grow stronger, there's got to be a balance in there, but one has to consider more than we have in the past, I think, the risk that we're playing and how our microbes change in this world. And it's as many of these things in medicine, it's not an isolated process. You cannot just get rid of one side of it and everything will be good. But it's certainly something that has been tolerated and overlooked for a very long time.
We have perhaps about 5-6 minutes left. Just to very quickly, let me introduce again the guest, Dr. Helmut Albrecht. He's professor of clinical internal medicine, director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at South Carolina School of Medicine. We're talking about AIDS and questions. Welcome. Someone wants to call real quick, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just something else that you might touch on, and this is, again, something in the way of something we can say that is positive. Among those groups that are at risk for acquiring HIV are babies that are born to moms that are HIV positive. But it seems that we actually now do know that we have the means to cut down mother-to-child transmission, not to zero, but pretty close.
If I find an infected mom early enough in their pregnancy, we can virtually guarantee, if the mother is willing to do the right things, to have a baby that's not born HIV positive, which is a huge change from what we had before. Again, it doesn't work in all accounts. We still have mothers come in after their water broke, and it's too late in certain cases to prevent the transmission, but we've been very successful in changing the transmission to babies.
Mm. We talked earlier about the fact that one bit of positive news is that over time that fewer people die. So it is possible now with proper treatment for someone who is HIV positive, perhaps to live a normal lifespan, or at least to live decades, although at the same time, that may be dependent on their ability to get top medical care. Now, the Obama administration has said that they were intent on trying to cut the nation's HIV infection rate. In fact, that their goal that they set was to cut it by 25% over the next 5 years,
mm-hmm.
Particularly by targeting their prevention efforts in those communities where they're hardest hit. They also want to try to make it possible for people who are HIV positive to get care. And that gets to the question that, you know, can we say now that there are people, or maybe how many people do you think there are who could benefit from the cutting edge therapy that we have now, but who cannot get it?
I think we have the means to do it. We just have to define our priorities and eventually put the money where our mouth is. Right now, from last year, for the HIV care that we provide, we have 5% less federal funding, and I have 11% more patients than I was seeing last year. So, yes, I can stretch our resources, but overall, for our medication funding, we have 11% less from the federal side. In our particular state, we have 50% less state funding. I'm supposed to buy $18 million worth of drugs for our patients here, and I only have $11 million. I can't stretch that. So we will leave some patients without meds, without care, which means that they are more infectious. So eventually, yes, the goals are all great. What I didn't care for so much in the plan was how really we're going to do this. And I don't think those ideas are so developed yet. We're dealing every year, again, I have almost 10 times as many patients as we had 20 years ago, but I have almost the same funding, barely more than 150% of what we used to have back then. You can stretch a dollar so far, and if you want to do this, we have to treat, we have to test, and we have to provide care so that these viruses do not become resistant and that we keep this in check. And eventually, we will have to come up with a domestic agenda that will actually allow us to do this. Yeah. Right now, I don't see it, in all honesty.
Now, early on and when people were first becoming aware of AIDS, there seemed to be a great fear that AIDS would spread much further than it has. Early on it was identified, the high-risk groups were identified, gay men, injection drug users, but there was a lot of talk about how it would spread like wildfire into the heterosexual population. And that perhaps some people at the time argued that maybe, well, that was a good thing to talk about, everyone being at risk, because it made people aware and perhaps also lessened the stigma somewhat. So the message was everybody is at risk. Well, the fact was that that's not true. It probably never was. Clearly, some people are at much greater risk. So I think now some people look back and say, well, was that old approach a mistake? And now have we done, though, too much of the other thing? Has the pendulum swung too much the other way, where we get people in this frame of mind that says, well, there are these narrow groups of people that are at risk, and so that means I'm not at risk, so that means that I don't have to worry about it.
Right. I think the pendulum is swinging back. And always with something like this, again, that has 10 or so years of incubation period, if you neglect one group, the others will take over. It has, for instance, in my state here, significantly been driven into the heterosexual transmission range, and it's certainly a major problem here. 1% of the world population having this virus, that's unprecedented for any epidemic. So it's not a minor issue. Having 2 to 5 million deaths per year is certainly not a minor issue on a global scale, aside from the cost associated with this. But I think we have to come to terms with that there's groups with higher risk, but as long as you have sexual activity, you will have some risk. And I think having everyone know their status and responding appropriately to this, some people will stay idiots even if they have a positive diagnosis, will not change their behavior, but most people actually do. So the approach finding as many as we can sort of being able, having the funds to treat them and making them less infectious makes a lot of sense to me personally.
Hmm. Just one thing quickly here, and I don't know that you probably don't want to comment specifically about the case. It has, however, been in the news here. A German singer, a pop singer, is on trial for knowingly having transmitted HIV, who being HIV positive and having sex with two other men, and at least I think one of them has turned out HIV positive, and so the charge is knowingly passing on the virus or knowing that the risk was possible. And I guess the question I have is criminalizing infecting someone else, particularly if you do it knowingly, do you think that that's an appropriate thing? Is that helpful?
Probably not. On the other hand, I can understand the outrage and the legal implications and the personal implications. I think you have to take a responsibility as a sexual partner of anybody. Just because somebody tells you that they are not infected or have been tested, guess what? People will lie to you. If you take that as an approach and then have somebody else to blame, you'll still live with the consequences. So the criminalization of the person that gave that to you is not the answer for this epidemic, and certainly it's going to make it more difficult for people to be open about it. So I think in the long run, we'll be shooting ourselves in the foot. On the other hand, there are people that the only way you can take them out of this loop by endangering other people is literally to take him out of this loop.
Mm. There, we're going to have to leave it. We're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Dr. Helmut Albrecht, is a professor of clinical internal medicine, director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at South Carolina School of Medicine, Columbia, South Carolina. And Dr. Albrecht, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you.